reading from the Sri, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, Part 1, Text 41. I actually did this verse last time, but I'm going to do it again, and I have a different strategy on how to cover this, which I'll explain. So I'll read the verse. Samapati, complete absorption of the mind, when it is free from its vrittis, occurs when the mind becomes just like a transparent jewel, taking the form of whatever object is placed before it, whether the object be the knower, the instrument of knowledge, or the object of knowledge. Om Jnana Timurandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Taksur Unmulatam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Pancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Shindu Bhayevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Srivasade Gaur Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ramo Hare Ramo Rama Rama Hare Hare So greetings from Besant Falls, usually I tell some kind of, relate some kind of story of, you know, where I am, the preaching, but I'm just here and having a happy, dull life. I remember when Rabindra Swarup Prabhu was in Govardhan doing a Namvrata, and he has such a cutting intelligence and a wit, and he just joked. He said, this movement really needs people who do nothing. And of course he didn't mean nothing, but just meditation and chanting. And so it's nice for me, I had a little hectic travel schedule, just to have that regulated life where I'm reading and chanting. And this morning when I got up, I decided that when I get up, let me just read some of the Bhagavatam. And I really get amazed at the depths of those purports by Srila Prabhupada and how they just come out of the page. And it's kind of reading Shastra and reading the purports of Prabhupada like this in his books. What it is almost, you know, I read them, not my God, I've been a devotee, you know, over, well, quite over 30 years. So I read them then and I read them now. And there's so much more. So what I see is, you know, it has potency, but there's a filter. And as you become purified, when there's less filter, there's more effect of the same thing. So the Shastra, it's so potent and it's so purifying. But you're able to perceive and understand it more and more and more as the Shastra itself purifies you. And in the Upadeshamrita, Prabhupada gave Rupa Goswami in that verse. What is it? It described that our condition in this world is like being jaundiced. When you have liver disease, when you have jaundice, then that which is sweet, tastes bitter. You can't taste the sweetness. But it acts as the sugar cane acts as a medicine, And as you become purified, then you can more and more realize the true nature of what you're tasting. So I felt that way with Prabhupada's book, so nice. A little Krishna book in the evening, a little Bhagavatam in the morning. And Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. That by regularly Nashta Prayeshu Abhadre, that which is inauspicious goes from the heart. This is the message of reading the Shastras. When you do and you hear in the proper way, what is inauspicious, what is anartha, what has no value to your ultimate objective of realizing the self, it gradually goes away. So I'm enjoying the regulated life in that way, which is necessary. Here's my realization too. You know, these are a little bit deep sections, and what I thought is they have long purports. Is you know, study more deeply and just try to summarize the whole thing. I'll go verse by verse, but maybe summarize the whole thing, and then go back and read certain parts that I underline that will fortify the points. And I also realize, this is a strong realization, is the value of a book. I don't know how I was teaching this class by reading it on the computer. There's just something inefficient about that. I don't know, I just love the yellow marker and the black pen and, you know, reading the purports and sitting. It's just something else. So studying it now that I have the book, it's out. And I thought Rutti would order them, but actually speaking, you know, I think he said you can get them on Amazon.com for about $23. So even if we got the discount, it would only be a couple of dollars less than that. So you can buy the book if you want. And those of you in the, you know, Vaishnav tradition, just understand that there's certain things that are different. I think Ramanuja said, Mama Muni pointed this out, you know, up to the stage of samadhi, it's great. You know, we have Sankhya and yoga and everything's there in the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, and it's a science how the mind works, but the ultimate conclusion is a little bit different. Even though this is not impersonal, it's still not exactly lined up with the, so you just have to be a little careful in that reading. So we're up to the point, you know, this section, part one, which you've been studying extensively, is really, you know, it's the practice, but it's more the goal. It's this meditative absorption. The next section that we go, the next chapter, we'll discuss the practice. So we've come up to the point where he discussed various objects that can be used for meditation. Because again, this meditational process, it's a strategy, and it's a scientific process that deals with how matter works. And there's a very, very deep metaphysics, which I think modern science yet hasn't really discovered, but it is a science, and it's a very, very deep metaphysics of how the mind works and what it's composed of and how it's influenced. And this meditative process is very strategic. You focus on one thing, because so many vrittis or thoughts, basically born of passion and ignorance, although ultimately you have to transcend even goodness, but that means goodness that's not pure goodness. So you have to, so when you focus on one thing, and therefore all these other impulses, they're subdued. And that has a tremendous transforming effect of the mind, bringing it to sattva, or lucidity, where one can see things clearly and ultimately understand the self with the, through the instrument of that type of pure mind. So there's various ways to do that, and that was discussed. And basically, it came to the conclusion, really, you can meditate on anything of your particular inclination, because this is, although Ishvara Pranidhan, the worship of God, was, although optional, I think a strong case can be recommended, can be made that it was actually the recommended, because it's the only object of meditation that is active in the transformative process. You can meditate on a candle, the mechanical aspect works, but there's no reciprocation from the candle. If you worship in God in terms of God's names, then you're not only getting the benefit of controlling the lower impulses and bring the mind to goodness, but because that's a devotional activity, then there's reciprocation from the object of your meditation. And, you know, the Bhagavatam is filled with such verses, Srinvata Svakata Krishna, Punya Shravana Kirtana, Hidyantisto Yabhadvani Vidanoti, that Srinvata Svakata Krishna, when you hear and chant, Srinvata Svakata Krishna, Punya Shravana Hidyantisto Yabhadvani Vidanoti Surit Sitam, for that person who is devoted in that way, Surit, Ishvara, the Supreme Lord, is close at heart. He purifies the heart. And so now we're in a section that's a little bit different, because he discussed various objects that could be used to support the mind in meditation. Now he returns to something that he briefly mentioned before, the stages within the meditative state itself, irrespective of what object you are. And again, I want to really point out the relevance. I'm going to describe a little bit of the details, but I think the relevance of this is how difficult this path is. And you'll see how subtle and the level, you know, even the beginning level of concentration seems almost unimaginable, but there's different levels of meditation where the meditation becomes more and more and more and more and more focused. And there's an analysis in the purport that we'll finish with how the commentators relate this to the chanting and how to get deeper in chanting of the holy name. But basically what's going to be described here, and I'm going to try to summarize it, and you'll just get a flavor of it, is that there are actually seven stages of samadhi that's actually going to be described here. Now, remember, there were two basic stages, one called Sampragata Samadhi and Asampragata Samadhi. Sampragata Samadhi means that there's meditation, but still dependent on the instrument of the mind to focus. And Asampragata Samadhi, which is the goal of this type of yoga process, is when the soul is near bija. It doesn't require anything material. It imbibes in its own, it lives in its own nature. So those are the two differences. And this Asampragata Samadhi, it has four different levels of depth of meditation, four basic ones. The first one is called Vitaraka Vichara Ananda, and Asmita. These are the four. But what's but it gets more and more subtle. And I think if anything, if I don't get into the exact details, you'll get that sense of the depth of this science of the mind, and perhaps why the recommendation is there to worship God, because as mentioned, you know, it can easily be done then, because this is all mechanical. If the object of your worship is not God, it's all mechanical, and therefore it all depends on your own powers, basically, your own level of determination and dispassion and renunciation and practice. And therefore, most yogis did meditate on the syllable Om, because it seems to be pretty clear that there's reciprocation in even in this mechanical process of controlling the mind. It's God who's the controller of everything. So by taking the help of God, it's facilitating even this mechanical process, basically, of yoga. So the meditation begins, and here what it's mentioned, this is called samapatti. Samapatti means there's a, and this is really within some pragyata samadhi where you're using the mind, the complete absorption occurs when the mind, it becomes like the object. In other words, you're so focused on that object that that's the only thing in your consciousness. And the mind actually transforms into that object. And the example is given like a crystal. A crystal reflects the object. So when the vrittis, when the fluctuations of the mind are down, the mind becomes very crystal clear, and it becomes colored by what it sees. So this is a kind of trance, and you're just seeing this one thing. So the mind is so focused and so steady that it's just a one object becomes, and therefore everything is still. And you know, I even had that experience a little bit today. I mean, okay, sometimes if I'm chanting in the morning, there's a beautiful waterfall near here, really, really powerful. And I like a little universal form meditation, you know, just go out and see God's glory and see that powerful water just rushing and understand no man can make this. No matter how great the scientists are, they cannot make a powerful waterfall and supply it with unlimited water. So I crossed the bridge, and then I, you know, I went and I sat, and there's a particular sitting place where you see the falls, and it's really beautiful. And I think this is like Vaikuntha, because the beautiful trees and the falls coming down, very, very powerful waterfall, rushing, rushing, rushing. And then I walk over the bridge, and then I stop for a second, and I'm just looking at the waterfall. And, you know, the water going under the bridge, and it's churning and churning and churning. And for a minute, I meditated on that, and then I realized there's a certain peace. Why? Because it stopped the fluctuations of the mind. So I was just meditating on the water. It was just natural. And reading the Yoga Sutras, but it stopped everything else, and that's our anxiety. That's the passion. That's what distorts the mind. These fluctuations, it just never stops. Here it is, even in the practical world. I just walked out in the country and just looked at the water and just meditated just on that one thing. It stopped everything else. So this is a kind of, so in this kind of meditation, it becomes so pronounced that your mind reflects that object and practically becomes that object. So here it mentions that this is called samapatti, absorption of the mind. And it's the samadhi is a general term. but this almost describes what happens. At least when you're using the mind, and that's just not, you know, when you're in unsaprajnata samadhi somehow, where the self is just absorbed in its own nature, that's different. So it becomes whatever object is placed before it. And then it gave the different types of objects. Well, the first object you can meditate is an object of knowledge, an actual object. So it's describing the yogi would meditate on an actual object. And then it says the instruments of knowledge. So there's a little bit of a deeper meditation. You're not just meditating on an object of knowledge, but somehow or other, the sense itself. I know sometimes the yogi may just meditate on, you know, breathing, I guess, the nostril or something. You meditate on just the sense itself. And then the knower, and that means the soul. Then there becomes a particular stage where because the mind is material, the mind cannot really know the soul. So there's a sense that the mind acts like a mirror and it reflects the awareness back to the source, kind of. Thus indirectly reflects the soul as a mirror reflects a face. So you come to the point where you're meditating on the... And it describes here that it's very interesting that in this type of the mind, which is material, it kind of molds itself into the form of the object. And not only that, it's a certain type of penetration into the object's very essence, almost like becomes the object and really understands deeply the nature of that object. It's a very, very deep meditation. You really get into something and into the essence of something, and it becomes completely absorbing. So this is the basic principle. Now, then it says, in this stage, samvitarka samapati, samadhi absorption with physical awareness, is intermixed with the notion of word, meaning, and data. So I'm going to go back again. I'm going to just repeat it. That there are these four stages of samadhi that were mentioned before that are being described here. The samprajnata samadhi, where it uses the mind. And the first one is called vitarka. And vitarka samadhi means you're going to meditate on a particular physical object. That's what vitarka. So the first type of samadhi is you're meditating on a particular physical object, and that has two divisions: subvitarka, with physical awareness, and what's that other one called? Nirvitarka, without physical awareness. So it goes something like this. So it says, when it's with physical awareness, this is like the first kind of meditation, right? The first is meditating on a physical object with physical awareness, without physical awareness. So when it's with physical awareness, it says it's intermixed with the notion of shabda, a word, jnana, idea, and artha, the object itself. So in the commentary, I gave an example. It's like you're meditating on a cow, and superimposed or conflated with that object is the word of that object and the idea of that object. So when you're at this stage of meditation, they're all kind of mixed together. You're meditating on a physical object, and there's a linguistic indicator consisting of a spoken phoneme, and there's a mental an idea. So the yogi begins to meditate like this, and as his concentration, and his awareness of that object is conflated with the word for and the concept. And this is known as Subhitarka Samadhi, absorption with physical awareness. So the concept here is then you come to another stage of meditation where, I can tell you something, I don't realize this because I'm not at that level of samadhi, and even when they're describing it, I can give the basic concepts, but this is samadhi, so there's no vrittis or thoughts. But somehow or other, there's some scars, there's latent impressions. So it's kind of a non-discursive insight to the object and its meaning somehow. But still, you're not seeing the object in its own right, on its own ground of being. It's tainted by the imposition of some conceptual thought on it. So you're meditating the object, but it's with some conceptual thought that's conflated or mixed with the object, which is the idea and the word. So that's one type. Then it describes the second type of this vitarka. Again, there's going to be described four different levels of prajnata samadhi: vitarka, vicharu, ananda, asmita, and they're going to get more and more subtle. So my hope is the appreciation is just describing of how deep the meditation could get. So in this vitarka, so subvitarka, with physical awareness, it's tainted by conception of the thought and the idea of it. And then nirvitarka is somehow or other, you come to a level where it's almost super conceptual. The yogi is, and you realize that why Vishwamrita Muni was meditating for, you'll see in the Shastra where it mentions like why they would meditate, why it was in Satya Yuga when people lived 100,000 years, because you needed 60,000 years to perfect these meditations. And people were in goodness, so they could actually, you know, do this, because that was in, and they also had an attraction for it. And the attraction was also, it's kind of like Sachi Sutta here. Sachi Sutta here is, he signed up for what's called the Iron Man. It's some kind of race, but I forgot what it does, but it'll take him 13 or 14 hours to complete the race. And he has to train for a year, probably about 27 hours a week with special diets. And then he does this race. And he enjoys it. He enjoys the challenge of the difficulty of it. If you tell him, why don't you just run, 5 miles, there's no pleasure in it. It's the Iron Man. There's a whole culture of people who do these things, and they train for a year. Such Akeli Lita's sister, last year she ran the Iron Man. And it's kind of a yoga also, because you got to transcend the mind. But they like it. In Satya Yuga, people were spiritual athletes. They liked it. That's why when you just say chant the holy names and do mantras, they weren't attracted to bhakti simply for the fact that it was just too easy. They couldn't. They wanted the challenge. That was their nature. And that's why when you talk about trying to perfect oneself in this kind of meditational process in this age, when you go through, and I hope I get you some idea of the subtleties involved. Now, this is the beginning stage of samadhi. There's no vrittis. It's just some latent samskaras, and there's somehow a physical object becomes your consciousness. And it's purifying and bringing the mind further and further to pure sattva, pure goodness, with the goal of eventually meditating and purely on the soul. See, here he says, Nirvitaka means non-conceptual, or perhaps more accurately, superconceptual. This occurs when the yogi's chitta or mind has been purged of any memory awareness of what the object is and what is it is called. That's the beginning of samadhi. And in other words, no imprints pertaining to the cow, because they activate on any subconscious or intuitive level whatsoever. The Chaspati Mitra says this type of object awareness is real yogic perception, because conceptual, artificial notions and names are not superimposed upon the object. The object itself stands forth on its own right, free of designations. So, it's a pure perception of the object with nothing superimposed on it. And it's described, this is what we say, tadvidi paripatena paripashnena sevya upatekshanti te jnani nas tatvadarshana. One is seeing reality. It's experiencing reality directly. So now the next verse, this, because he mentioned it a little bit in the purport, Nirvitaka samapati, absorption without conceptualization, occurs when memory has been purged and the mind is empty, as it were, of its own nature. Now the only object of meditation shines forth in its own right. So in other words, you're the object comes purely into the consciousness. Free from any cognitive identification or self-awareness. Again, I'm going to repeat it because in this Sampragyata Samadhi, there are four, so this is Vitarka. You're meditating on an object. One, it's conflated with conceptions, ideas. One, you're seeing the object purely. So it's a deeper experience and a deeper meditation. Now the next stage is be called vichara. And vichara means you're not meditating just on it's the second second of the four stages of samadhi. It also has two divisions, sa with and near without. But the difference here is where in Vitarka you focus on the gross object, either with conception or you directly experience it. And here you're focusing on the subtle elements. It's when the meditative focus becomes absorbed in, they're called tanmatras, subtle elements underpinning it. The analogy that was given is good. It's just like you have an iceberg. So it's a solid substance, or you can perceive it deeper as the fluid water, or still deeper as solidified vapor. And you can go further in the analogy, and then it's hydrogen and oxygen. So in that way, this first stage of samadhi, it meditates on the gross object. Now, in the second stage of samadhi, it meditates on where it comes from, something more subtle. And the object of meditation deepens, and the yogi penetrates further and further into the object, into its subtle elements. But it still has cognizance of time and space. So it's meditating on the subtle elements, so it's sub-vichara, but it has with cognizance of time and space, and the yogi still has some awareness of space and time. So again, the conception I'm trying to give is what this process is and why it was described, recommended to Satya Yuga, where they said people lived for 100,000 years. And why in that level of concentration, people had to be celibate. Why people had to be in seclusion, why they had to go up in the Himalayas, and why it wasn't really a practice if for ultimate perfection that can be easily practiced in the modern age, this kind of level of meditation, and why at the minimum, Ishvara Pranidhan, worship of God, had to be the object of meditation for the reciprocation. Because to go through these levels yourself, we can hardly conceptualize it. So then there's this Nivachara, and the yogi focuses on the object unconditioned by dimensionality. He can focus not just on the subtle nature of an object, but he transcends space and time. And so this is another level. In other words, the form of the object dissolves, and he's simply experiencing vibrant, subtle energies pervading kind of reality or something like that. It's Now let me read a little summary, maybe get this a little clearer, where it says, Harihadananda uses the sun as a rough but useful example for the four types of samapati. Again, samapati is when the consciousness becomes clear and like a crystal, and it reflects this object. So there's four ways it can reflect it. It can reflect the gross object with some conceptualization, the gross object directly, then it can focus on the subtle elements, the vibrations of the subtle elements become, and then it somehow can meditate on that, but without any sense of dimensionality. So it says, Sivatarka is analogous to focusing without distraction on the sun, cognizing it as an object of a certain shape composed of fire atoms and situated a certain distance with some intuitive awareness of its name and function in the natural scheme of things. Nirvitarka Samadhi can be compared to the deepening of one's focus, that one sees the sun as a luminous object in the heavens without awareness of its name, size, distance, etc. Savichara corresponds to perceiving that the fire element of the sun is actually the subtle element of light, but one's awareness is still circumscribed by specific location of the sun in the universe and by the fact that it is perceived in the present rather than the past or future. Whenever all awareness of space and time dissolves, and one sees the pure light, devoid of color, pervading not just the sun, but all things at all times, in other words, one is aware of omniscient eternal light, then one's meditation is Nivachara. This is only the second stage. This is the second part of the second stage of Sampragata Samadhi. And that's my impression. Look already the level, and it's still not the perfectional stage. There's still two more stages. So then it describes the next one. So there's the Vitarka, Vichara, then there's Anand. So what Anand means is somehow or other everything material, like the senses, I got it. Let me just read the commentary here now in relationship to chanting. This may be Advaita, so let's read it together. So he says, we can now return to Shankara. That's a commentary's claim that the recitation of Om, along the lines indicated in these sutras, culminates in a supersensory face-to-face encounter with God. Quote, by the perfection of repetition of Om and meditation on the Supreme Ishvara, the Supreme Atman situated in the highest place, shines forth for the yogi. End quote. Given the centrality of the chanting, japa, it is important to bring the the greater insight from the technical information on these sutras to bear in discussion of the recitation. Okay. So it says, this is one commentator, he says, in the Subhitaka chanting, Om is mixed with the conventional meanings and ideas that we know define. So we're chanting, and with the chanting, we're hearing the name, and it's superimposed with our own conceptions, with our own mental notions. Then he says, in the Nirvitaka, these are eliminated, and God begins to manifest from the sound in his own pure nature, unobstructed by the concocted images and association of the yogi has forced it. So he's meditating Om, and he has certain mental conceptions conflated with the sound vibration. Then he's just hearing purely. And it's nice, you know, when Prabhupada was recommending about chanting and meditating, and, you know, some people want to think of so many things. Prabhupada said, basically, just hear and think of the meaning. This is the science. It's recommended even the Yoga Sutras. Just hear the name and think of the meaning. So here he says that that's a higher stage here, in at least in yoga, that you're experiencing without your concocted images and associations. But then in the third stage of chanting, as the chitta's focus on the recitation of the mantra deepens, one penetrates into the inner essence of the sound and actually begins to experience, that is, directly perceive God. The yogi's mind is now completely absorbed in the vision of God, that he or she has lost all self-awareness. So this is really samadhi. It's also described, I know, in the Bhakti Sandarbha, when there's no cognizance. Samadhi means you lose cognizance of what's outside. And when the great Vaishnavas meditate and chant the holy name, the holy name, and they're hearing purely, and they penetrate, because that's the idea. The mind can penetrate. When the mind is pure and sattvic and becomes concentrated, the mind can penetrate. And it can understand the essence of things. And when it understands the essence of the holy name reveals its guna, its name, its form, its qualities, and pastimes. It's not superimposed. It's revealed. And this is what Prabhupada taught. It's revealed. So here he's describing the yogi meditating on Om. And these are the different stages. Same one. And then let's see, the final stage of the yogis, in the final stage, one's absorption in this vision of God, Ishvara, is extracted from any notion of time and space, and Ishvara is experienced as the infinite and eternal supreme being. One just becomes completely absorbed and transcendental, and merges into an eternality, not that you become God, but you enter into the godly realm. So it's interesting. So now the final two stages, and this is just some pragyata. It says the subtle things, nature of things, extend all the way up to prakriti. So prakriti is the ultimate subtlest cause of everything, because it cannot dissolve into anything more subtle. So it describes here, it's very interesting, first is five gross elements. They're the last thing, the most grossest thing. They're not considered subtle, because there's nothing that's more subtle than. To be subtle, you have to be more subtle than something else. So it's the last thing, and then the tan mantras are considered the subtle elements, because they can produce these grosser products. And then the subtle elements are the product of something subtler. Now, in Sankhya, in different ways, here, buddhi is more subtle than ahankara, and I think in the Sankhya that we study, perhaps ahankara is more subtle than buddhi. But the basic point is, there's something always more subtle until it comes to prakriti. It's the subtlest thing, because there's nothing more subtle. There's nothing more subtle than it, and the gross elements are the grossest things, because it's not more subtle than anything else. So this is, because this is, This is the, there's vitarka, vichara. Now this is anand. What happens is, so and then there's ahankara, and still subtler is buddhi, and then subtler than buddhi is this prakriti. So why is Patanjali saying this in the sutra? Is because the meditative focus of the yogi, now he's not just penetrating. First, in Vitarka, it was the gross elements. Then he was able to penetrate to the subtle elements. Now, at a higher stage, one is penetrating to the subtlest thing, which is prakriti itself. And as one approaches the most subtle levels of matter, then you come to sattva, because sattva is the true nature of being. In its purest form, matter is in goodness. So what happens at that stage, one of the inherent qualities of sattva is joy or ananda, because that's the nature of goodness. Thus, when the yogi's mind becomes focused and absorbed in the subtle dimensions of reality, and space and time are already surpassed in the previous stages, it comes in contact with sattvic and blissful quality that underpins all material reality and the purest state, and the yogi experience bliss. And this is not even the bliss of Brahman. They haven't even achieved the bliss of Brahman. And then the next stage, which is called asmita, which is the fourth stage of Sampragata Samadhi, which is not even Asampragata Samadhi, then somehow or other, finally he penetrates the essence of reality further. The yogi encounters, some very, very deep state. And, you know, he's able to reflect the nature of the soul, and he's just meditating. Although it's reflected from matter, asmita means I-ness. He's just his own nature. So basically what I just tried to do is just try to give you an overview of these seven stages. Again, there's vitarka, and then there's savitarka, nirvitarka, then there's charu, there's Sachara, Nirchara, then there's Ananda, you get subtler, and then Asmita. And then there's Asampragata. So that's seven stages. So any wonder that this process was really recommended mostly in the Satya Yuga, where the nature and environment was pure and people were longer lived and had that karma and nature to do these Iron Man meditations. Well, anyway, I summed up a lot of verses, but anybody have any questions? Okay, anybody like to say hello?
Hi, Krishna Maharaj, I do have a question.
Gail, did you understand something?
Yeah, I did. I did understand something. Okay. A lot of things I didn't, but
I tried to give a general gist. I don't think the details.
No, I think it was generally pretty clear. The only confusing part, which is not my question, was when you were talking about the how about subtle and gross. Subtler and subtler and subtler, or gross.
Well, there's gross that elements, then subtle than the gross elements, there's an underpinning more subtle than that called tanmatra. I'm not sure exactly what it is. And then more subtle than that is ahankara, and then more subtle than that is prakriti, which is the basis of matter or something.
Matter is not
subtle, because there's nothing grosser than it.
That's the line I didn't understand.
There's nothing gross. If there's matter, for it to be subtle, there has to be something it's more subtle than. It's not. It's the five elements are the grossest manifestation of prakriti.
Okay. Yeah.
Earth, water, fire, air. There's nothing, that's the grossest manifestation. Okay,
right.
What's your question?
You said that the pure state of matter is sattva. You know,
that's
goodness.
What it literally means. It's kind of, I describe like you have a mirror, right? And the mirror is, it can be, it when the mirror is in its pure state, right, it can reflect things perfectly. And when the mirror either becomes dirty or distorted, then it doesn't reflect things perfectly. So, and I try to give that example to describe that's what sattva is. Sattva is a kind of the pure nature of matter before it's kind of distorted by passion and ignorance. So there's something about in Sankhya about matter having a pure state where it's very, it's like an instrument. It's like an instrument, like a knife that's very, very sharp, can do its job. And when it's dull, it can't do its job. So when it's very, very sharp, it's its pure state. So it's something like that, because sattva literally means something, the nature of being.
But the reason why I had a question about it is because I thought that nothing is, you know, I thought that it's our consciousness that determines the mode that something is in. You know, that...
But it's like a microscope, right? A microscope, you're looking through a lens, right? So the lens allows you to see things clearer or not, depending on the shape of the lens. So, and if you say, you know, what is, when our consciousness is pure, there's a certain degree, because what is it? We're working through the instrument of the mind. So how we perceive things is through a material instrument, although it's not conscious. It's used by consciousness to perceive things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you say the mind is pure, it's almost indicating in one sense, I mean, at least on the gyanic path, it's in when the mind is pure, it's indicating that matter is shaped in a particular way that allows the consciousness to perceive things in it. And if you want to perceive the true nature of being, the true nature of things, then, you know, somehow or other. And the question is of course, consciousness affects that. But when you're in the material state, and this is on the gyanic path, the discriminatory path, the dispassionate path, when you're on that path, then it's material. How the mind is formed. The mind is still material. The soul is always considered pure, right? The soul is unchanging. It can't be split. It can't be this. It can't be that. So it's like a person. I would give the analogy. It's like a person who is healthy and is dreaming. So he may dream this. He may dream that. He may dream he's sick. He may dream he has a disease. He doesn't actually have it. He has a particular condition, whatever he's dreaming. So this world is like a dream. So you're having different states of thoughts, but actually there's a constitutional thing that doesn't change, and that's the soul. It's just that somehow or other the perception becomes altered in many ways. You know, I've realized this also, Gail, in discussing these subjects. This is dealing with the darshans and things. There's so many different schools of thought, and it becomes so complex. And I'll tell you very frankly, I have a basic understanding of it. And I think even those schools of thought that have definitive understandings of a particular way, they're also questioned. I know Mahamuni right now is working on a paper, and his paper is actually really, in one sense, wants to refute some of the yogic conceptions from the standpoint of Vedanta. And they're very, very subtle points. So I don't know how much more I can explain or how much more I wanted to give more or less a general idea. I think for us the relevant point is the complexity of intensity of focus that one has to go through on this meditative path. And is there any reason why Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita said that, you know, to control the mind is more difficult than controlling the raging wind? And then Krishna says it is possible by practice and detachment. But that's why eventually bhakti is recommended. Because bhakti, the object of meditation, is an aid in itself. It's not just an inert object to create to focus. It's an object that reciprocates to increase your focus. Okay, Gail, now everything's clear.
Well, no.
I didn't think.
No, I mean, my question was, if, like, Arjuna's conch shell that he blew, it was transcendental because of his consciousness with which he used it.
Right.
Somebody with a materialistic consciousness, they would have made it a conch shell in the molds. And so I don't understand why you say that, you know, matter is, you know, automatically in the mode of goodness. You know, it's like irrespective of the consciousness with which you use or deal with the thing.
Okay, I'll explain it, and then I'll just give one answer. Our consciousness will bring matter to a particular mode, okay? It will bring it to its pure mode. Our consciousness will bring it to its pure mode. Obviously, consciousness, you have what's called kshetra-gya, right? That's the body. We have a particular field of activities which we have influence on. But beyond any matter that's connected with a particular body, there's a fundamental principle of matter that's separate from that. And that's why they've described these tanmatras. It's beyond our body. It's the principle of matter, which is outside even our particular body. And that particular prakriti, it's a fundamental principle of matter. Yeah. And when someone actually contacts that by his meditation, somehow he can, I guess, access that and use that to experience something. I understand your point, Gail. I'm going to think of it further, okay?
Okay.
Anybody else have a question? I really will, Gail.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. It's a valid point. I can understand exactly what you're saying, that, you know, it almost seems that from here what it says that matter itself is conscious, you know, because it has some kind of ananda in it, and ananda seems to be within the soul. But there seems to be an influence of matter or something that on consciousness that allows one to experience that. Okay, anybody else like to say hello?
Hare Krishna Maharaj, please accept my humble obeisance.
Hare Krishna, Amir.
Thank you for class.
Okay.
Did you say that buddhi is more subtle than ahankara or the other way?
In yoga it is, but in different schools of thought they have in different ways. As far as I can understand, in the Sankhya that we have, the false ego is the most subtle thing. Okay? The ahankara. Okay,
thank you.
Anyone else like to say Hare Krishna?
Hare Krishna, Jai Jai Swami.
Jai Jai Tamar, do you want to help me here?
Love to. If only I had the qualification.
Well, I'm trying to get the essence of it, of how subtle it is, but that's basically my realization of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're going to be at Shastras now? Are you there yet? When are you going to be there?
Yeah. I'll be there, probably from about the 6th.
From the 6th.
Uh-huh.
The 6th. Ooh. I'd like to be there when you're there, but I can either come before or after. Okay, anyway, we'll see. Okay, the 6th is a Thursday?
Is the 6th a Thursday? Let's see what this turns. Yes, the 6th is a Thursday.
Oh. Okay, and when will you be before then?
Philadelphia for 3 days.
And you're leaving Philadelphia when?
Say the 6th. You know.
On the 6th.
Yeah, it's a little flexy, but that's the idea so far.
Okay. We'll see. Maybe I'll visit you there in Philadelphia then or something. Okay. That's an idea. Okay, thank you. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay, one more person.
Hi, Krishna Maharaj. It's Karunika in New Zealand.
Karunika, thank you for being steady on this.
Oh, I wanted to thank you for the posting out of the Yoga Sutras thing that came through the email. I read it. It was
the Yoga Psychology thing.
Yeah, the Yoga Psychology. That was really, really amazing.
I'm really getting a lot of good feedback on that. People really like it.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, everyone. Vanchakopa Trubya Shakabasindu Viva Chapati Tanam Pamani Bhavishmi.